This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors. And this week there was only really one thing we could talk about, the unmistakable arrival of spring. Give you a quick word picture. Mid-Stockett Road, there's a church. Now, all four square, granite built, big spire going up in the sky. There's just a hint of light in the sky, so the sky is sort of sapphire blue, quite really dark blue. And then off to the ridge of the church, there's just a line of seagulls. They were making a racket a second ago, needless to say, because the programme started, they've gone quiet now. But off to the left of that, there is the most beautiful moon, which I'm reliably informed is a snow moon. That's a really bonny picture. Good morning, I'm Mark Stephen, coming to you live from the BBC Aberdeen car park and coming to you from the delights of bucolic Banffshire, Mr. Ewan McElroof.
Yeah, good morning. I was just about to inform the nation, oh, there's a lovely full moon out there. Did you know it's a snow moon? At least I'm going to credit the source for this, which was Fiona, our producer today. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295. Lewis is taking your calls. He's on 08 085 92 95 00, and the sun is just... well, it's definitely ready pink on the horizon. Looks like being another gorgeous day.
Yeah, it was beautiful yesterday. It does feel very much as if spring has sprung over the last couple of days. Having said that, I never entirely trust it for the first few weeks. You know, just keep that simmer on. You just can't be too careful. March is just round the corner, and we're going to be celebrating the longer days and milder weather on the programme today.
Yeah, what a difference a couple of weeks, mate. You know, we're knee-deep in snow 2 weeks ago. Now the sun is out yesterday, and I'm reliably told there's 3 tonnes of gravel to be moved today. What joy. Also coming up, I discover the tale, and this is absolutely brilliant, the Electric Wizard of the North. Now, Fiona discovered this guy, and it's got a real twist at the end. But first, the mystery bird. Last week was pretty tricky. We got some complaints, so this week's even harder. Okay, have a guess at that. Do you know what bird makes that sound? You might. Yeah, there probably are people out there who do know what that is. But anyway, have a go. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number, 80295. And you can call 08 085 9295 00. We could just do the seagulls in the background.
Yeah, no, the seagulls are making a nice sound now. See that 3 tonnes of gravel you were talking about? When you got married, is it possible that you might just have, rather than getting married, accidentally have inherited an overseer?
Pretty much so. And since she retired, part of her ritual in the morning is walking round the estate looking for jobs.
Well, you'll not get bored. Look on the bright side. As we were saying, it's feeling very spring-like here in the northeast, and we love embracing this new season wholeheartedly.
It started last week with a robin song. Caught as the sun dipped below the western horizon. And it was the sudden realisation that you don't miss something till it's part of your life again. That robin, high in the leafless cherry tree, proclaiming a coming. singing a message of hope, of spring, and new life yet to come. Above me now is a chaffinch, puffed up and singing, not against the cold, but full of the joy of now. For spring does what it says. It springs up on you from nowhere. Overnight, the drifts have gone. Snowdrops abound. Crocuses insinuate themselves into the forest floor, accompanied by the exuberant thrusting of daffodil. Woodpigeon call in dull repetition. Rooks scour the storm-bound forest in search of that perfect twig. The field fare that last week glared at me from frozen bush, demanding yet another apple, has gone. My services are no longer required. All because the gift of spring is in the wind. It affects not just wildlife. The landy starts first time again. The postie smiles. It's time for shorts. Through snow and ice on summer tyres, the wee red van has made lockdown possible for the likes of me. The sky glows now before the morning alarm. The sunset red accompanies the evening chorus. All born on southern winds. Behind the nightmare of a COVID darkness, before us the murmur of spring, the hint, just a hint of a summer yet to come, and all round the gift of light seeps deep, deep into our soul. And above me the chaffinch and the pheasant calls. Just bring it on.
The joys of spring there. Stay tuned as I have a go at celebrating this new season by putting pen to paper as well. Got some comments coming in at the moment.
Yeah, the competition for poetry and verse heats up. Lorna Nelson says, saw some lambs in a field today and felt really encouraged and then thought about tonight's bright, clear, rising moon reflecting the sunlight before the sun actually went down. It was lovely. Spring is on its way. Bronwyn Denton Davis says, morning birds waking me up. And Printup says, snowdrops, then daffodils, then iris. And Robert F. Morrison says, the beautiful blossoms on my earliest peach tree.
See, I've got a comment here from Gwen Blair, who I suspect is Alan after Ken better, saying, morning, Mark and Ewan. Poke your listeners to get out of bed right now. I'm not sure that's legal, Gwen. Open the blinds and look at that fantastic moon, should the skies be clear. Up D-side, you could read the newspaper. It was a bit like that when I got up this morning, too, came out of the house. Anyway, yep. Thanks for those comments. I'll exercise pack. Or even a lockdown exercise pack from around the country this week comes from Neil Milgai. An old colleague of this programme, Linda Sinclair, came to Malawi with us, is going to be taking us for a cycle.
So, as you might have detected, I live in a flat. So, when lockdown started, it was just so important to get outside and get some fresh air and just get some exercise. So I got a mountain bike last year in September time, the first time I've had a mountain bike for a long, long time, and it's been an absolute godsend to help me to get out into the country and just go exploring. So today I'm going to go out onto the West Highland Way and up towards Mugdock, towards the reservoirs, and do a little loop that I quite often do. I normally do this one when I'm running, but at the minute I'm injured from the running. Thus, that explains why I've been doing a lot more cycling. It's about 7 miles or so, and it should take about an hour on the bike. But it's just really interesting landscape and really lovely trails. And the birds are singing. It feels like spring has sprung after all those days of cold weather and hard snow on the surfaces. It's all changed now. All the snow is gone. So I've now come to a bridge that crosses the Allander Water. And now I'm on the West Helen Way. Mogai is around a quarter of a mile back the way. I'm picking up, heading north. And now the Allander Water is to my left. It's a really popular area with dog walkers and runners and walkers. So I'm just having to navigate around a few of them right now. And quite soon, I've got a really steep climb coming up, which if anybody who's walked the West Helen Way will know exactly where I mean. Some artworks on this particular part of the trail. So the important part here is getting into the right gear. Here we go.
Good girl.
Don't think she was talking to me. Right, that's me stopped at a signpost for a sort of information sign for Drumclog Moor, which is part of Mugdock Country Park. And according to this information board, you'll be able to see kestrels, bog cotton, small pearl-bordered fritillary. Now, what is that? Bright orange and black markings are easy to spot. Oh, it's a type of butterfly. Bog, asphodel, round-leaved sundew, and cranberries. Well, that's a surprise. I must come and look out for them in our time, see if I can actually spot any. And a stunning views up here towards the city, the tower blocks in the distance, and the Kilpatrick Hills over to my right-hand side. And I'm now just a stone's throw from Mugdock, from the reservoirs. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to cycle round the side of the reservoir towards Strathblane Road. But before I get there, I'm going to stop off at a water fountain. All the snow has been replaced by massive big puddles, so I didn't really come equipped for that. So no waterproof trousers on today, which was a big mistake. Anyway, I'm not out for too long. So I've just stopped at this water fountain, which I usually use in the summertime if I'm out for a long run. And I'm imagining with this cold weather that it's not working, but let's have a look. Oh, it is working, so I'm going to have a wee drink. Now, I never really paid much attention to this monument, this memorial, until I was about to come and do the cycle, and I thought I'd do some research. So it turns out it's a memory of James Gale, who was an engineer to the Glasgow Corporation Water Department back in the 1800s. And he was one of the engineers, one of the chief engineers involved in the construction of this waterwork scheme. So to put you in the picture, Lough Katrine out in the Trossachs feeds into this by a series of aqueducts which graduate down. And then this water supply here serves Glasgow and the greater Glasgow area. And that was all constructed in the Victorian era of the 1800s. And the scheme was opened by Queen Victoria. And partly it was really important to get this water supply put in place because it helped eradicate things like typhoid and cholera, which was rife at the time. So James Gale is a picture of him here in this monument in bronze. And a fine-looking man he is. He's got his curly hair and a little beard and his resplendent clothes of the day in bronze. And it's quite splendid. I don't think anybody really notices it when they come past here. So I'm right out round by the reservoir now and getting buffeted by the wind a little bit. But the sun's come out and I can see as far as Fenwick Moor and the wind turbines, Springburn, the tower blocks. And on a clear day, I can almost see as far as Tinto Hill in South Lanarkshire. I can't see it today. So I've left Strathblane Road behind me and I've come into Douglaston. Now, I'm just at the start of the Douglaston Woodland Walk, and there's an information board here. Now, I've been coming here for years, actually, running mostly, and I've never once bothered to stop it and look at this information board. And what it tells me is quite interesting, quite an education. This was once owned, this estate, by John Glasford. Now, that's a name I'm sure will ring a bell with you. He was a rich Glasgow tobacco merchant born in Paisley. Now, he bought this place in the 1700s, and there was a mansion here. He was instrumental in planting the woodland and building some lochs here too. Of course, his name is very controversial. With the Black Lives Matter movement, there were calls for Glasford Street in Glasgow to be renamed because of his connections with the slave trade. His empire was built on the slave trade. A very controversial man indeed. So I had no idea about this history of this place. Another interesting thing, according to this board, is this trail I'm on just now was one of the original carriage ride routes. So he would have used this route, making his way into Glasgow city centre. So that's something I'll forever think of when I'm cycling along here, is that I'm following in the wheels of the carriage of John Glasford.
Linda Sinclair there, and I was just thinking that when we all went to Malawi to do those programmes, she and Fiona Clark, if memory serves me right, went off horse riding at one stage to do a piece on that, and a leopard crossed in front of them. I don't know what our horses would do if a leopard crossed in front of them, but it wouldn't be slow.
And I'm wondering when we're going to get bronze statues erected in the Beech Grove car park.
In our magnificent clothing of the time, indeed.
Yeah.
I'm Etienne Kubwabo, a filmmaker and writer. I want to tell kids in my community and beyond around the world that they can do whatever they put their minds to.
I'm Vanessa Canby, a Scottish Ghanaian podcaster, presenter, filmmaker and mum. I really love to point out injustices and shine a light on untold stories as well.
We're here to get the word out about Word Up, a brand new podcast bringing together a mix of guests from Scotland's diverse communities.
We'll introduce you to inspiring people from a wide range of backgrounds and cultures.
Taking a good look at each other and, you know, trying to figure out what connects us and brings us together as humans.
Yeah, just Word Up.
So join us by searching for Word Up on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. Okay, heaps more coming up in the next hour or so, including a First World War airship base that I knew absolutely nothing about. And the sheer delight, the joy of hearing kids back at an outdoor nursery.
Yeah, the whole basis of this programme is things I didn't know. It's brilliant. Anyway, here's something that many people don't know. Here's a mystery bird. Okay, loads of wrong answers. I don't know, should we give it a clue here or not? Can you think of a...
I can't think of a clue off the top of my head. I did hear this bird quite recently when I was out walking.
Really?
You know, before the sun came up,
There's two different kinds. One of them is indigenous and one's an imposter. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Think colour. 08 08 5 92 95 00. Lewis is getting a wee bit bored, so go and make his morning.
Lewis isn't getting bored in the slightest. Lewis has rushed off his feet with wrong answers, but never mind. Every year, international mountain leaders from across the UK, many of them training in Scotland, head to Europe for work. However, changes post-Brexit mean this is now pretty difficult, and it also makes life difficult for those expat leaders already living in Europe. To tell us more, we're joined by Ian Speer, President of the Union of International Mountain Leaders Association. Good morning, Ian. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Just explain, A, what a mountain leader does, and then how people worked and travelled, what the lifestyle was pre-Brexit.
Well, an international mountain leader leads in the summer trekking and hiking. So a very famous route would be the Tour Mont Blanc, for example, covering three countries in one trip. In the winter, they're involved in activities like snowshoeing. They work with a lot of commercial groups, young people and adults as well.
So how's that changed now, and why has it changed? Because presumably some folk were based in Scotland and they went across to Europe for the summer?
Previously UK mountain leaders were working around Europe and they would have a pretty level playing field with other European mountain leaders. And the experience was basically pretty good. They were commuters, so an international mountain leader in Scotland would travel to Chamonix in the French Alps, set out on a trek into Italy, on to Switzerland, back into France, and a lot of people did exactly that. So what has changed? Well, there's now a regime where we require work permits, so that's quite a big difference.
And how difficult is that practically? I mean, you're based in Switzerland. What changes has it meant for you?
Well, we think that they will need these work permits, that's completely new. What we're now seeing is that mountain tourism businesses are saying quite reluctantly that this is so difficult that they can't see a path to employing UK mountain leaders. And some of those companies are international. There's a Canadian company I've heard from. And some of them are owned and operated by UK nationals. So you can imagine that they're heartbroken to be saying that to their colleagues. The international or the European Confederation of Outdoor Employers has said that they think the employment prospects for UK nationals are not really very good. We've seen practical difficulties that you might expect with a new bureaucracy. It seems to be difficult to apply for a permit far enough in advance to make proper business plans, but there's not enough flexibility for people to fulfil short-term commitments. So that's going to be pretty difficult. We're now basically third country nationals, joining the rest of the world, but nevertheless. I know from my international role that the experience of third country nationals in Europe is really not very good.
What does it mean for people who are either currently training in Scotland to be mountain leaders or who have already trained, you know, who normally reside in Scotland?
Well, people that are embarking on a career in outdoor leisure will typically have more than one thing that they do. So being able to work in Europe was a part of that mix. So I think people might step into related activities if they haven't already. But as a profession, we're going to lose some of these young professionals. And the UK will withdraw from something that we were pretty good at and we were taking a lead in. And of course, existing professionals will say that this is no longer practical. We are still able to work in other countries outside of Europe, but commercially the demand is not as strong as it is in Europe.
Because a lot of, certainly when Mark and I were in Chamonix, I was amazed at the number of Scots that were kind of working as ski guides maybe during the winter in Scotland, then went to Chamonix for the summer months. Presumably a lot of these guys and girls are trying to plan now, and it's quite difficult.
It's incredibly difficult. Of course, we do have a situation with a pandemic which has made things extremely hard for everybody, but we have spent the last 4 years really hoping that some provision would be made for us, that we could carry on. We were commuters. We would like to carry on as commuters, and now we can't do that. So, yes, it will be very, very difficult for them.
What's the solution to this?
Well, I think it's a question of commitment, isn't it, as with many things. So during those negotiations for the trade and cooperation agreement, the potential for short-term business visitors to not require work permits was discussed. And the UK government has repeatedly said that that was something they wanted and that it was rejected by the EU. And that was repeated as recently as Thursday, in fact, in Westminster. A minister from the Department for Culture, Media and Sports said exactly that. In the same way, the EU back in 2020, March, made a proposal for 90 days work in a 180-day period. So they would be practical solutions. So I'd say really to the Westminster government that, well, you know, let's not argue about this or point fingers or apportion blame. If we want to do this, if it's a policy and we understand it's important, then I think we should just roll our sleeves up and get it done.
Do the politicians see what you do as being important, though?
We've had a number of extremely positive contacts over the last few weeks with members of the House of Lords and members of the House of Commons. So they are seeing and appreciating that this is important. But I would also say we're one sector of very many. There are a lot of people that are having a similar problem here. Musicians and performers have been in the press recently, of course. So there is no particular special case for any one sector. We all are seeing this issue.
Ian, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you very much.
Ian Spear there, President of the Union of International Mountain Leader Associations. It's a bit of a tackle.
It's a difficult one, though.
It's a difficult one.
Yeah, especially for folk like, you know, like musicians, but, you know, guys like mountain guides, absolutely. That is their life, itinerant lifestyle, and if you've got to apply for a work permit every time, Yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah. There seems to be an awful lot of stuff at the moment that need to be unpicked and sorted. You may have seen already on BBC Scotland trailers for a new TV series called Gold Town, which starts next Sunday evening. It's the 7th of March. Now, it's a three-part series. It's going to focus on the gold mining industry at Tindrum. I don't know if you remember, back in December we spoke to Richard Gray of ScotGold, the company who actually owned the mine, and I asked him, how do you go about extracting the gold?
It's very, very fine. It's much finer than the average gold that the guys find when they're panning in the area. And so what we have to do is we have to take the ore out of the mine, and we then have to break it down, crush it and grind it until it's about the size of a tenth of a millimetre in grain size. It comes like a sand. And then we extract the gold by gravity, by spinning it, so that the heavy gold separates out, a bit like a pan, and also by flotation. And we basically put it in like a jacuzzi with some washing up liquid, and the foam all comes to the top, and the foam attracts the sulfide minerals which have the gold in it, and then we scoop the foam off the top.
I can hear folk at home at the moment thinking, hang on a second, we've got a jacuzzi. We could be doing this too. And what is it? What is your gold, you know, Scottish gold from your mine, actually look like? Is it distinctive?
To be frank, no. I mean, the point is that we have the proven provenance. We know where it comes from. And that's what gives it its extra value, is because people know that's the hill, it's come from Tindrum. We have a proven chain of custody all the way from us to the refiners and back to the jewelers. So anybody buys any gold from us, they know it's certified that it's come from us.
That was Richard Gray of ScotGold, the company who actually owned the mine at Tindrum. Admirable honesty. Is it unique in any way? No, not really. But we can prove it came from Scotland. That's the important thing.
Yeah, but it's hard. Right? I mean, you've panned for gold. I've panned for gold with spectacular lack of success.
Yeah, I hope they're going to be more successful than we were. Anyway, the TV series is based around ScotGold's attempt to become Scotland's first commercially viable gold mine. And the miners are very much the fore in the series. Here's a clip from the programme. This is Tony and Ian.
You never really know what's going to happen in the tunnel.
No. Just hope nothing happens.
I think you have to be a wee bit kind of crazy to like it. You're not really seeing daylight. So it can be quite tough that way. And the night shift's even worse. You go down the tunnel, you come back out and it's dark. And then sometimes you go down and it's dark and then you come out and it's light again. It confuses you. But it's been quite enjoyable too. If everything runs smoothly, it's quite enjoyable. If your teammates help you enough to. Now most of them. I'm not saying it's you, Ty. I'm just saying.
Did he call him Tatty?
Or did he did I miss call him Tatty.
He did call him Tatty?
Yeah.
It's not just me.
It's because they plant them deep underground.
All together now.
Yeah, I tell you, mining is a profession I never really aspired to.
No.
Hats off to them, but it's a scary place to be.
Yep, that's the forthcoming series of Gold Town. As I said, starts on the BBC Scotland TV channel this Sunday, 7th of March at 9 p.m. So probably worth a look-see. We're getting umpteen answers in for the mystery bird. So far, every last one of them is wrong. Gary and Pennycook. Exactly. Gary and Pennycook says, sounds like a seabird of some kind. Razorbill? Nope. Oric in Largs says, just out walking the pooch on the beach in Largs and thought I'd throw my bird guess into the ring. Is it a fulmer? Probably not, but I do love the show. Keep up the fantastic work. See, that's the way to get your comment right.
That's
Oric,
the way
well
you
done.
Do it, yeah.
That's it. Trish says, heard Lark sing at Temple yesterday. Is the mystery bird a nuthatch? Nope. Richard and Mandy in Exeter. And I see where they're coming from this. Could it be a starling? With a perfect moon, which means the dog didn't bark when we let him out first thing. Why are those two things connected? What? I don't understand that. Never mind, I don't know. Jeff from Edinburgh says, is it a kittiwake? Mark Smith says, that's not a bird, that's somebody scratching their nails down a blackboard. It's not, but I know exactly where you're coming from. David in Carlisle says, morning guys, is the bird this week a tern? Love the programme as well. But again, you know, yeah. Can we just hear that sound again, Ron? Would you mind sticking it in?
Yeah, I can see where folk are coming from. But it's not a seabird.
No.
It's not a seabird. In fact, it's a long way from the sea.
Yes.
These birds, nearly said it, absolutely hate water. And there's a reason for that.
And Malcolm from Creef and Paddy in Aberdeen both thought it was a water rail, but we've just said this bird does not like water, and there is a reason for that. So you're going to have to work with the information you've got so far, and we'll play some more when we actually come into the other side of the hour.
Yeah, but we all think, you know, go back to the right, it's not a seabird. It will find it far inland, and we have two different coloured species of this bird. Yeah. One is indigenous, and one was imported. It's a strange sound, but well, I'm not going to give away too many clues, but yeah, forget the seabird thing.
I'll tell you what I just heard there just now, and it came shooting out of the corner there.
A peregrine.
The peregrine. I heard the peregrine baiting again.
Oh, can you hear it now?
I can't see it, unfortunately. Now. Unless that's on top of that finial. I'm not sure. I need to start bringing binoculars in. Old age cometh not alone. Coming up on the programme will be a rather spooky encounter with the electric wizard of the northeast, and climbing through the ice mushrooms, if you know what such a thing is, I don't personally, of Patagonia.
And why don't you go with the mystery bird where the clues are paying off now? Have a wee listen to this. So, Katie in Perth got it right, Barry Sutherland's got it right, George Grant and Nettie Bidge's got it right, Andrew Barry in Broxburn's got it right, and Mary in St Andrews has even given me the Latin name for it. So get in touch. In fact, this is interesting, because the Latin name gave us one of our favourite Christmas carols. Get in touch, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, 80295, and call Lewis, he's busy now, 08085 92950.
Earlier this week, I was able to get back out and continue my journey along the Fermartin and Buchan Way as the ice thawed on the former railway line. It was just lethal beforehand, it was out of the question. Now, with that route in mind, a fellow called James Harvey emailed us to say, I believe you're travelling the old railway line, the Brock soon, that's Fraserburgh, proper Brock, not the other one, and was wondering if you were looking at the history of the airship base at Lenebo. I know Longside well enough, having landed there a few times, but know little of nearby Lenebo, he says. Well, to be honest, I'd never heard of the place. But we found a man who knows a great deal about it, local historian Sandy May, MBE, and we met up, took two cars out there, and he showed me around.
Early in the war, the shipping was getting bombarded with submarines down the east coast here, and they had to find a way to stop the German submarines, and they thought the airships would be one way of doing it, because they can stay up there a long time, because back in 1914 the airplanes didn't have
basically paper and string.
That's right, but they could put up the airships and they could stay up there for maybe 12 hours, in fact a couple of days in some cases.
The airships were presumably on patrol across the shipping lanes, looking for German submarines.
Yes.
If they saw a German submarine, what could they do?
Well, they could throw bombs over the side.
All right, okay, so they were
as basic as that.
Attack. It wasn't an observation
thing. No, it was observation was the main thing, but if they saw them, they had these bombs clipped to the side of their canvas.
Yeah, the way you described the airship, it sounds like a pretty dodgy posting. I'm not sure I would have enjoyed going up in one.
Well, no, because the early ones, they were entirely open air, and they had four or five men in them, and they had absolutely no comfort. They had no cover. They had no cooking. Well, they used to fry sausages and eggs and things on the manifold of the engine. And that's why they got a hot meal.
Aye. Well, that would work. That would definitely work.
Yes.
And what was the air base actually called here?
Lenebo.
It's an unusual name round about here.
It is, really. It's a Gaelic name, and it's to do with cows grazing, because it was kind of moorland. It's about 1,000 acres.
And it's boggy. Completely unsuitable for actually building an airstrip.
Totally unsuitable. Why it was chosen, we don't know. This is the big bases for the sheds. There was actually three sheds here. They were 100 feet high, and they were 500-600 feet long. The thing is, there's not so much to see here now, but for I remember at first, there was quite a lot of the big... They're probably still in the woods there, some of the big anchoring blocks, and there's slabs of concrete about 5 feet high, maybe about 10 feet by 10 feet. Massive blocks, and that's what they tied them down.
These are lighter than air craft.
Yes.
I mean, it always kind of looks counterintuitive, because you look at something that massive and you think it can't possibly be lighter than air, but it works like a boat. It's, you know, it's a mount that's actually displacing.
Aye.
It is a ship, an airship.
Yes. Yeah. It was a naval as well. It was naval, all the airships, you see.
In order to lay the cement in the first place, they must have had to clear off a heap of peat off this. So how did they do it?
Well, they had about 1,000 navvies when they started, and they had some machines at that time.
Steam shovels and the like. Yeah.
So, and they cleared it all in a year and had everything up and running within a year, which was the contract time, I think. Yeah. But one of the reasons they maybe chose here was water. Loads of water. Being a boggy place, water everywhere.
Why did they need water?
They needed water to make the hydrogen for the airships.
Well, they actually split the water so that they produce hydrogen and oxygen, and that gave them the gas?
Yes.
How did they do that? Because that's enormously energy intensive.
Well, they had plant and everything here. I can let you see some photographs of the plant. It was all self-contained here.
Have you got any photographs with you of the ships themselves?
Yes.
What I really want to do is get some sort of sense of scale in this thing.
Well, that's some of the base, look.
Aye.
Some of the huts. Here's the big shed.
This is a massive plant, and in keeping with a lot of the stuff from the First World War, it was got rid of because it was the war to end all wars.
That's
so at the end of it, they thought, well, there's no point in keeping this anymore.
But not only was it that, it was the end of airships. And, of course, one of the things when the locals saw these things, they called them Lenovo Sous.
Sows.
Yes.
As in pigs.
They look like a pig,
they just look like, you know, aye, quite. So effectively, it's not cigar-shaped, it's teardrop-shaped.
Well,
kind
that
of sharp
one is,
at one end. Okay.
That would be a C-class.
Okay.
C7, look.
Okay. For all the world, it's like a rowing boat hung underneath this thing.
Yes.
You know, it's got the RAF roundel on it.
Aye.
Good grief, it looks pretty primitive.
And when...
How are these things powered?
A little engine. And there, look, that's the propeller there.
That is the propeller for the entire thing?
Yes.
It's nothing.
It's nothing.
It must just have moved no more.
It had just been... Oh, they were just like...
Chaff in the
wind. 5 mile an hour or something like that. It was pretty pathetic. You know the old Petters engines and stuff long ago? Well, it was just a little engine like that, I think.
Just thudded its way through the skies.
Yes. When a ship was arriving, a siren went off, and they were called to muster, and they had about 100 men to take it down or put it up.
It's just extraordinary that, you know, all this was here, and there's no sign of it at all now. I would love to have seen this in its heyday, just to see one of these things coming out. I mean, how dramatic would that have been to see something that big being pulled out of a shed?
The thing with this place was that there was all these buildings, and then the war finished, they planted trees, and they all grew up, and nobody saw anything. And then they cut down the trees in the 60s, and there's all these, well, there's two big chimneys, I think, are 60-odd feet high, and all the other buildings and tanks and goodness knows what all. And they got the army to come in and blow them up.
Tends to be what the army does. Sandy May there, MBE, and the remarkable tale of Lenovo Airship Base.
That just had me spellbound there. A, great storytelling, and B, another chunk of Scottish history that I knew very little about, and certainly I had no idea that was an airship base. That must have been a scary thing. But how they thought they were going to sneak up on submarines with a thumping engine and 5 miles an hour is a bit beyond me.
No, I honestly don't know if there's any record at all. And if you know, we'd love to, you know, love to find out any record at all of one of these things actually doing any damage in the slightest to a German U-boat, or even getting anywhere near one. But
they're making their own hydrogen on site as well. Just incredible, splitting the water and then being on a floating time bomb.
Well, yeah, but I'm trying to remember where it was. Was it Fair Isle? There's old military emplacements right up at the top of Fair Isle, and they were blown up. But, you know, and to blow those, because, I mean, there was very serious, very heavy-duty construction. I remember the glass in these, it's nearly an inch thick, you know, whatever, you know, the sheets of glass that were in the windows. I don't know what the purpose of it was, but, you know, seriously, give the Royal Engineers anything, they'll take it down in no time at all, assuming they don't steal it first.
We'll blow it up. Dennis Forbes Grattan's been in touch. He says, spring in Bonnie Buckspun with the birds chirruping their heads off and the crocuses in full bloom as the weather has changed in 1 week from bitter winter to sunny spring. This is frustrating. The river is ready to fish now that the grue is cleared, but the 5 mile limit stops most anglers, certainly in Aberdeen, from accessing the rivers. Roll on, the end of lockdown. Well, yeah, so see all of us.
Absolutely. David Balhavi is the chief executive of the John Muir Trust. Now, David took up his post at the start of 2020, but before getting stuck into his new role, he embarked, along with his son, on a climbing trip to the ice fields of Patagonia.
Yeah, as you do, because it's not every day you hear of somebody climbing in Patagonia, so we're keen to find out how the trip came about.
When I was young, father was doing the Golden Eagle Eyrie Service, so I was always climbing in and out of eyries to look at either the prey items that were in the nest or how many eggs were there or whatever when you couldn't see in, so they could look at breeding success. So I had an affinity with climbing, but not with the technicalities of it. So the rope work and so on was not that familiar with to me, but picked it up. But then, like many climbers, I guess you get to a stage where you're involved in a few serious accidents and your mortality comes to the fore, and you have children of your own, so you back off for a while. So I went through that stage, and then my sons, when they were younger, got really interested in climbing, and both of them are quite reasonable climbers. And I remembered from my youth seeing, at the time, there was a guy called Messner had climbed this mountain in South America called Cerro Torre. It's just a big granite spire with a great big snow mushroom on top of it. And I looked at it and I thought, well, first of all, I've never seen anything like that anywhere in all the mountain books I've read. So it's unique. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And I thought it'd be impossible to ever climb it, but it'd be nice to see it. And I'd expressed that to one of my sons, and he said, well, why don't we climb it? And I thought, well, you know what? At the age I am now and how stiff and old I feel, I think that's just impossible. So he convinced me anyway that there was enough innate in there to give it 2 years of really hard training. Just trained really basically in the you know, Scottish climbing scene for 2 years. Got my skills sort of set back up, got my fitness as good as it could be. And then we set off to do what is, and I make no bones about it, it's probably the easiest route on Cerro Torre. It's called the Ragni route. And by easy, it's still incredibly hard. But the ultimate, you've got a head wall to go through, which is sort of four pitches of steep climbing. But the exciting part of the whole climb is to climb through these mushrooms. So the mushrooms are formed by rime ice. And I know for those of us who are lucky to walk in the highlands or up in the mountains in the wintertime, you'll see that these feathers of rime begin to form on rocks where you've got moist air gathering. And in effect, it's that process taken to an absolute extreme as the moist air blows across the Patagonian ice cap and then hits these really high granite spires. This rime builds up and builds up and builds up, and it forms mushrooms. And then the wind hits the cliffs below and blows tunnels up through the rime mushrooms. As a climber, the golden ticket, if you like, is to climb up through one of these ice tunnels. But you're climbing with a sort of kilometre and a half of exposure below you on fixing, or yeah, your safety's not great, so you're relying basically on your belays. So you've got good belays, but trying to fix ice screws into, or snow stakes as it is some of the time, into these ice mushrooms isn't the best protection out, so you're likely to take a whipper. Anyway, bottom line was we didn't get a chance to get that far just because the weather window didn't open up, and I think that the first people to climb Cerro Torre in the year we were there climbed in the week after we got back to Scotland, which was unfortunate. I think there was about 40 people got to the summit of Cerritore because there was the most amazing weather window opened up. And Cerritore in the right weather conditions is doable and reasonably safe. It's desperately dangerous in the wrong weather conditions. So, you know, it gets down to, it's not high altitude climbing, it's only sort of just over 10,000 feet. Your biggest risk is obviously poor weather, which brings on avalanche or rockfall. And if you play the right head game, then you should stay reasonably safe.
You want to have another go at it?
I'd love to. Yeah, I'd absolutely love to. I've got to watch the. I've got a huge awareness of the carbon footprint that takes to get down there, and that's something that I need to look at for the rest of my life. The carbon budget that I want to enjoy and what my aspiration is to be able to walk the walk, if you like. But that aside, it took quite a while. It took probably 6 months just to come to terms with not getting to the top after training so hard, but. Yeah, the size of the, put it this way, the size of the climbing gym at home is getting bigger. And I'm beginning to huff and puff again with some training in mind. So,
executive of the John Muir Trust there, David Balhari. And you can hear more from David on the Trust, his career and those ice mushrooms on the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now. He also speaks at some length about land use. He's got some very, very interesting ideas on that, Ewan.
Yeah, it's well worth a listen. Some of the carbon taxes, some of the carbon options, and some of the future for upland estates. He's got some quite creative ideas. Certainly well worth a listen. There's a lot of debate on land reform, carbon credits, a lot going on in Scotland at the moment.
Indeed.
But I would be so relieved not going up that. The thought of climbing up a nice tunnel with a kilometre and a half of nothing below you is scary.
It is. I don't know how vertical the tunnel actually is. Because when you see, in my mind's eye, I thought, well, at least that you've got some sort of sense of protection. It's not that absolute exposure of just looking behind you and seeing a kilometre and a half. Oh, don't know. Gives me the willies just thinking about it, to be told. Anyway, some kids were able to go back to school and nursery for the first time since before Christmas recently.
Which means that the sound of children playing in groups can be heard in playgrounds around the country.
But also in the woods. Our senior producer, Helen Needham, captured this sound of preschoolers playing at Mucky Boots Outdoor Nursery this week. And it just kicks off with a wee group sitting, listening to a story.
Buster's a dickie.
Later, Laura told the little star all her secrets, and it seems to sparkle more brightly than before, as if it were listening, as if it understood.
Okay, so Gigantosaurus and T-Rex, you're going to have to cover your eyes.
And Hank,
so it gives me and Grace a little chance to run away.
What number shall we count up to?
One, two, five.
We're going to count to number five.
Okay.
The sound of children playing at Mucky Boots Outdoor Nursery in Aberdeenshire this week. Apparently, roaring and rough and tumble have been very popular amongst the children this week, just letting off some steam after being stuck for weeks at home. Someone who's very familiar with that sound is Denise Bowie from Haddo Outdoor Kindergarten, also in Aberdeenshire. Good morning. Thanks for joining us, Denise.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Not bad at all, thank you. Not bad at all. It must be fantastic just to hear the sound of kids playing and having fun again outside.
It's absolutely wonderful. Wonderful to welcome them back, the children and their families, yes.
Explain an outdoor kindergarten to us. How does that work?
Well, everything happens outdoors. Regardless of the weather, we're outdoors all the time. So we have a Mongolian yurt with a log burner, and the children can dip in and out and warm up when necessary. And we have a caravan, some wooden huts and tarps for the wet days. But yes, it's all happening outside.
So what does it mean to have the children outside? I mean, how do they respond to that freedom to be outside all the time?
That is the word. They have the space and the freedom and the time to focus on their interests. So they're not following an adult agenda. It's all about what drives their interests. So when they arrive, the only sound on site is birdsong. It's a lovely, calm and unhurried approach. And, yeah, they come in and get on with it.
You really don't need to sell the idea to us. We think it's fantastic. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, here in Scotland, we internationally, we were a bit late to the party.
Yes, yes. I went on a wee tour of the places who arrived at the party before us. Had a look in Norway, Sweden, Finland, Iceland and Italy. And brought back some ideas, but really what I found was we're all just, if you're passionate about the outdoors, we're all sort of doing the same thing. Yeah.
What about parents are a wee bit sceptical about the whole thing? You know, they're used to, I saw something the other day, if the kids are banging their heads off the walls, take away the walls. Do
yes.
you have to sell it to parents?
Not so much. No, I don't think so. Perhaps in the past. But I think parents are fully on board, possibly because of lockdown. But what I'd always say is, come along and see what we're about. Come along and experience it for yourself.
Once the children have been through your system, you know, and they, you know, they've been out in all weathers and, you know, going for a wee nap in the yard and things like that, and, you know,
yeah.
working around fires and just generally having a wonderful time, what's the takeaway with that? Does it make it easier for them to go into traditional education later on and sit in classrooms, or harder? Or, you know, what do they gain from these early years' experiences?
I'd say what we're doing is future-proofing them. I think they're more emotionally robust and resilient. It's a challenging environment. It's an inspiring one, but it's a challenging one. And I think they come away with a greater sense of achievement and a heightened awareness of their own ability, which is great for their confidence. Hopefully they go into school and share that and ask for more time outdoors.
It's interesting, you can more or less spot kids that have had outdoor education, because, you know, the kids that don't, you know, it's like, I fell, you know, whereas
yeah.
the outdoor kids go, yeah, I fell, you know, and it's just, you know, just move on, next, you know.
Yeah, we'll turn around and say, are you all right? Up you come.
Yeah.
Rather than this notion that an adult needs to run and assist, you know, oh, let me help you up there. The children can do this for themselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Benign neglect, I'm a great believer in it.
Yes, absolutely, that's the one.
Does it improve their sense of risk as well? Because I remember speaking to somebody at Scottish Natural Heritage and said, we're taking away the barriers at the edge of cliffs because people rely on too many things, you know, the nanny state. They become more aware of risk. You fall off the tree, you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, they're very good at self-risk assessment. Again, a heightened awareness of their own capabilities. And, you know, what we'll say is, or we encourage them to think, do you feel safe at that height? So, for example, 4-year-old Cleo the other day was like, look at me, I've never climbed this high before in a tree. And just that whole feeling, the exhilaration, and it's marvellous. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was working up on the roof one time and heard a voice behind me, and I looked around, you know, and about 15 feet off the ground, having just climbed up the ladder, was my then 4-year-old. And I'm going, come to me, dear. Just walk this way. Your heart just stops. Listen, Denise, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
You're very welcome. I hope it'll be possible to come visit us sometime. And you can find us on Haddo Woodland Kindergarten on Facebook. A picture is worth a thousand words, so we're there.
It sure is. Haddo Woodland Kindergarten. Denise
yeah.
Bowie there.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks very much. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing when you listen to the podcast. Email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what David Robertson in Canada did. He says, "Hello, folks, from a very cold Calgary, Alberta." I'll bet it is. "I'm listening to your podcast where you've been talking about animal names in the Big Garden Birdwatch, and I wanted to share a lovely scene I saw last week. I was driving home after work while it was sunny but bitterly cold, minus 30, with wind chill minus 40, when I noticed a group of four or five adult bald eagles sitting in a large tree in the edge of the Bow River, where warm water from the local water treatment plant enters the river. It was a beautiful sight, these big communal birds sitting together in the late afternoon sunlight."
And by way of bizarre contrast, in summer we see pelicans on the Louise River. Pelicans, those noted birds of the prairies. I used to live in Pittenbedden, and this is what we do really well. Around the world, we get Scots to greet thinking about their homeland. The sounds and the descriptions of lapwings in summer took me back to the northeast for just a moment. Still time, though, to have a guess at the mystery bird. Loads and loads and loads if you're getting it wrong, but here's another one. Yeah, this is a bit harder than I thought. Think shades. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 and 0885 9295 00. Lewis is taking your calls, and it's not a seabird.
See that helpful clue that you just gave?
Yeah.
I have no idea what it means. None.
Yeah, but your producer will.
Ah, well, fair enough. This next piece is about a very interesting character that, it's like in most other things in this programme, I'd never heard of before. There are stories crop up every so often on the programme, you know, and this is the story of Walford Bodie, and it was one that Ewan just had to find out more about.
I'm walking down a street that I've walked many, many times over the years. I'm in the village of Macduff in the northeast of Scotland. It's a wild and blustery day, and I'm outside a house that's intrigued me, not intrigued me enough to investigate it more. But it's a strange building, half-timbered. It sticks out like a sore thumb against the architecture of the granite of northeast Scotland. This is a very different place. But it was only when it came up for sale recently and friends tried to buy it unsuccessfully, and they said, and it belonged to a wizard. A wizard? A wizard in Macduff? Was I intrigued? Oh, yes. And it's taken me on a bit of a walk of discovery, a walk round the village that's going to take me from this house to a drinking fountain and a grave. A grave with a secret. And a secret that very possibly has only ever been revealed to me. This is going to be quite a journey. Walford Bodie was born in Aberdeen in 1869. He initially worked for the National Telephone Company, but he wasn't cut out to be an apprentice. For Bodie, was a born showman with a deep fascination for electricity. By 16, he was performing in Stonehaven Town Hall, perfecting his act and taking the title the Electrical Wizard. Shyly, he called himself the most remarkable man in the world. A cape, a top hat, and a massive waxed moustache, he toured the world, at one time becoming the world's highest paid entertainer. The climax of his act being strapped into an electric chair by his assistant, La Belle Electrica, and passed 30,000 volts through his body, lighting 16 bulbs and two lamps, which he held in his hands. He even amazed members of the audience as lightning seemed to flash from his fingers to the volunteer. Dramatic? Yes. Dangerous? No. Harmless static of massive voltage. Think physics class and the Van de Graaff generator. He made Macduff his home, and he was rich. But there was tragedy as well. And I'm heading down the hill now to have a look at something I should have had a look at years ago. It's a drinking fountain that's about 20 feet tall in grey and pink granite, presented to the Borough of Macduff by Dr. and Mrs. Walford Bodie in memory of their daughter, Jeannie. Of course, he wasn't a doctor, which upset many people. Looking at this magnificent fountain and just realising there's so much on your doorstep that you just ignore. Well, I've left the fountain behind me and I'm heading west and up the hill. He also had another member of the family in the act, La Belle Electrica, as I mentioned earlier, and Mystic Marie. Now, if he'd stuck to being simply a showman, he would be remembered as a great entertainer. But electricity was his life, and he started performing bloodless surgery. He didn't charge for the surgery, but the patients were part of his stage show, as he put voltage through their bodies to cure almost every ailment. He started adding the title MD after his name, and he called himself a doctor. He was found guilty of misrepresentation and fined £1,000 in 1909, a massive sum. Bodie claimed MD stood for Merry Devil, but he continued to call himself a doctor, much to the annoyance of the medical profession, which came to a head in Glasgow's Coliseum one week later, when medical students stormed the show and pelted him with eggs and rotten food, chanting, "Bodie, quack, quack, quack." In 1931, his wife died. So at the age of 62, shortly afterwards, he remarried to a 22-year-old showgirl. Eventually, at the age of 70, he collapsed on stage in Blackpool, and the body was returned to the family plot up there on the hill in Macduff. And I'm in Doon Parish Church. And before me are two graves. The first one erected in memory of Mystic Marie, who worked with him for many years, and La Belle Electrica, who died in Glasgow. It's an imposing position. Mystic Marie's grave is about 15 feet high, paid for by Bodie, with a magnificent angel and a cross at the top. Now, I'm about 20 feet away from both of these memorials, and there's a reason for that. Now, I'm not dubbing this on. I've no idea if the powers of the Magician of the North live on. I'm going to go closer to Belle Electrica's monument. About 15 feet away. I'm not dubbing this on. It's real. I don't know, but it's a bit spooky. And I'm just going to walk back. I'm now 12 feet away, and it's gone. Just to prove this to myself, now, these monuments are physical, but perhaps it's more than just his memory that lives on here. What a strange end to our journey.
Walford Bodie, the electric wizard. You weren't just making that up.
No, I was completely shocked because I came up there, down the hill from the church and eventually found the grave, and I got beside it and I got this zzzz. I went back again, and I thought it was the microphone or the recording equipment.
Yeah.
So I went back to the car, changed the whole kit out and came back, and whenever you get closer than 10 feet, you get that zzzz. Now, you're a practical man, I know what you're going to say. I'm just saying, it was there, it was real, and I wasn't expecting it.
No, I'm just wondering if there was just, I don't know, if he was that fascinated by static electricity and magnetism and things like that, I wonder if there's just something buried down there too. I wonder how you could test for that. Fascinating.
Well, I tell you an interesting one. Gwen Blair's been in touch. She said Bodie was a friend of my grandfather, Jimmy Cowie, from Keith and Banff. And he used to tell us that Bodie lit his fags, from his fingers, even when they met for a dram. just fascinating stuff. I had no idea this guy existed till a couple of weeks ago, and producer Fiona said, have you heard about this guy, the wizard and Macduff? I thought, wow.
No. Not in the slightest. And you would read that fountain and not be aware of the backstory behind it in the slightest. You'd just assume it was a local doctor or something.
Yeah, well, I remember I looked years ago and that's kind of just, that's what I thought. And it's not till you know that backstory and marrying a 22-year-old and you're 60-odd. He was a bit of a philanderer as well. Also, a good friend of Houdini. They were big mates.
Right.
And Houdini gave him an electric chair from the electric. What's the island?
Oh, I was thinking Sing Sing too. It's Alcatraz.
Alcatraz, the electric chair that they used to, execute people. He gave Bodie one of them as a present, and as part of his act, he always hired an ambulance, which he parked outside the front door, just in case something went wrong.
Just in case. Yeah. Was it still sitting outside the cemetery?
No, it would be that. No, but it's one of the strange ones. You've had a couple of strange ones in the past, but
No, well, hang on to that.
Anybody got any thoughts on that? Give us a call. 0808 592 95 00. It was obviously, was it a radio mast or something? But the fact it was only at the grave.
I don't know, it might not have been. Back in 2017, I headed down the water, not in a paddle steamer, but in a powerboat. I went as far as Clyde Bank to one of its most famous landmarks. Sandra Henderson and Janice McKenzie were at the ready to give me a guided tour of a remarkable piece of engineering.
The Titan crane stands 150 feet high, it weighs 800 tonnes and its foundations go 80 feet deep and 80? 80 feet wide, yes.
Wow.
Yes, it's one of four cranes remaining on the Clyde.
I'm going to ask you a really daft question. Why is it baby blue?
Well, that's the original colour of the crane. And if you can see it, you can look through the fence here, you can see the remains of other blue cranes.
You know, just looking up at it, it's a phenomenal structure against the sky, beautiful against that particular sky.
Yeah, the cantilever that you see here, the big long arm part, is 240 foot in length.
Right.
Could lift up to 200 tonne.
Wow. Can you go up it still?
You can indeed, yes, I have. We've got a nice fancy lift.
Oh.
In the days of the yard, the yard workers would have to use the stairs here that wind round the legs of the crane. Uh-huh. But we're quite lucky. We've got a nice fancy lift to take us to the top.
Those are the guys here that erected the crane. This photograph here, it'll show you. Uh-huh. This wee laddie was about 11 years old, maybe 11 or 12. His job was to catch the rivets. So there would be four or five in a rivet team, and this wee boy would catch them. He would throw them using either tongs or a gloved hand to the riveters, and they would catch them.
And these were red hot at the time?
They were white hot, they were heated to over 1,000 degrees.
Wow.
The riveters, the welders, the caulkers, etc., they were known as the black squads. So they were paid by how many rivets, etc., they'd done, not by how long they spent in the yards. Right. The rivets for that day would be coated in a different colour of paint so that the supervisor, the foreman, would come round and determine how much wages they were due. Each day they were coated in another colour of paint. Yeah. The crane has just under 250,000 rivets holding it together.
You've never counted those, get out.
I haven't counted them all, but I've nearly got there. There was 3 million rivets in Titanic and 10 million each in the hood in Queen Mary.
Wow. Let's go and take a look from the top.
And the riveters had that good eye contact, apparently, that they fired them in like darts.
Seriously?
You'd have a man at the back holding the rivet in place called a hoderon or a hammerman.
A hoderon.
Uh-huh. And each riveter at that time, you would have a right-handed and a left-handed riveter, uh-huh. and they would take it in turns to get the rivet
back,
in.
Back,
uh-huh.
back,
and they were paid. Okay. They were paid. Probably a way back in the 1910s, they were paid about a penny per rivet. Per team, so that penny would, that old penny would have been divided between the four guys in the rivet team, and the wee boy, he would get his share from the journeyman.
Uh-huh. Right, let's go in. Here we go.
You going to be warm enough?
I'm fine.
You
yeah.
sure?
We're hardy as women. Yeah. Yeah.
We're like the Titan, made in Scotland, for girders.
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, this is fantastic. It's a glass-sided lift, so every so often you get these wonderful views down the river. Well, this is actually taking us above the cantilever.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we're going directly
we're
right above the cantilever.
Now.
Uh-huh.
OK, so we're just walking out onto the crane now. Now, we're standing on a mesh grid system,
uh-huh.
which enables you to be able to see straight through the crane, which is not very good if you're a bit wobbly on your feet.
So come you're looking down, how high up are we?
We are 150 foot high. If you were standing on the roof uh-huh. here, the wheelhouse roof, we would be 160 foot high.
I don't know what, I'm not usually bothered by heights.
This is the easy part.
Yeah, when, what do you mean the easy part?
There's a rougher part.
Oh.
When you get down to on other parts of the crane, you get a false sense of height.
Yeah.
Because you're looking down to, you know, down at the passages, other parts of the crane. If you go along, you're just looking straight down to the concrete, so that you feel as if you're much higher than you actually are while you're standing here.
But we're just looking up the river. There's the Erskine Bridge, etc. The flatlands off to the left-hand side. You're seeing right the way across the hills, Kilpatrick Hills. It's just fantastic views, though. I've never been up here before.
It's absolutely amazing. Every time you come up to the top here, you see something different.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We love it. We yeah. absolutely love our
crane. It's heritage. To me, it's heritage. I don't know how I'm going to feel when I see it all with Riverside Apartments and retail and a health centre and houses, because to me, sad as it is, it's heritage. And I can imagine the hustle and bustle and all the cranes mm-hmm. and all the shipbuilding that went on.
Everyone has a grandparent, an uncle, a cousin, someone who worked on the yard or yeah. knew someone who worked on the yard. It's such a big part of the community.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you look over here, you'll see the small inlet, the River Cart. Uh-huh. This was instrumental in the Thompson brothers starting here, because the river is very narrow, but all the five slipways that were on this side of the river, which is the east side, they all face over towards the River Cart. So uh-huh. that's what allowed them to be able to build and launch big ships diagonally across the river. Mm-hmm. They'd never have been able to do it across the bay, but diagonally they could. You had three slipways here in the West Yard, but the five here were the biggest ones, and that's where the likes of Queen Mary, Queen Elizabeth, QE2, Lusitania, Aquitania, etc. would have been launched from.
Because you've been talking, the pair of you, you've distracted me from the fact that I'm standing 150 feet above the cement.
Standing, where you're standing just now, you're standing directly on top of the driver's cab.
Oh, right, OK.
So if you look down, you'll see the small window there.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And that's where the driver would operate the Titan crane.
It's just monumental, the entire thing, and wonderful that it still exists.
Yeah.
And to be absolutely honest, it's wonderful that you pair are so passionate about
it,
too.
We love it. We absolutely...
Yeah.
There's nothing like a feeling of coming to your work, being able to talk about the things that you love so passionately. You know, we want to keep it alive. Yeah, for the Titan crane.
Yay for the Titan Crane indeed.
Yay.
Sandra Henderson and Janice McKenzie, they were just wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
I just love that enthusiasm. You know, the standing back listening to this programme, it really should be on the course for excellence. I mean, all that stuff about airships and folk we didn't know about in the Titan Crane. I remember when they put that straw Titan Crane up. It was wonderful. Hey, a couple of folk, Murray and Kyle... They said, is it a grouse or a capercaillie? No, but you're kind of on the right track. I'm afraid we'll have to find out on catch-up tomorrow, as we're just leaving to do another vaccination clinic here in Oxford. So well done, you guys.
Well, we've got quite a few correct answers, and I'm just going to run through some of them just now. Willie the farmer in a briefing came across a covey of 20 chicks of this bird last year. Best covey he'd seen for 30 years. James Smith from the Lambing Shed in Fife got the answer correct, really enjoys the show. Coxie in Dunkeld says it's a cracking spring morning, got the correct answer. Sandy from Dunlugas saying he thinks it is a blah. two options there. He wasn't sure which colour it actually was, but we're going to give it to you anyway, Sandy. David Long from Spottiswoods and the Borders saying song thrush is back and singing, a sure sign spring is on the way. Grace and David from Stowe says we think it's a blah as we enjoy our tea and toast in bed listening to your super programme. Sandy and Blair Gowrie got it correct, and he was talking too about the fact that Perthshire's made a remarkable recovery from the recent floods. In the last 2 days, the grass has turned that certain shade of green when it squeezes every ray of sunshine in its pursuit of growth. Fred Armadale, West Lothian, Pamela from Edinburgh, Derek working in Dalmahoy, and Rowan and Black Isle, all of them got the correct answer. We're going to tell them what it was yet?
I was going to let you know. People were asking about the clue. I was referring to a book, 50 Shades of Grey, because it was, of course, The Grey Partridge. Mention the partridge, and you can't help yourself, in a pear tree. Why was the ground-dwelling grey partridge, perdy, perdy, up in a pear tree? Well, it wasn't, but more on that later. It's a game bird and widespread in Europe. It's known as the English partridge, or the Hungarian, and prefers the field margins and the hedgerows, where it can feed on seeds and insects when young. It's a wee bit smaller than its cousin, the red-legged partridge, which was introduced here from France and Spain. It's got a distinctive orange face, and unlike the red, the grey is struggling and is now a redless species. And it doesn't nest in pear trees. It also doesn't like the sea or the rivers. But why? Well, according to folklore in the Americas, the partridge was the canoe builder for all the other birds. And on a certain day, everyone assembled and each got his canoe. And it was a wonderful sight. First of all, the eagle entered his great shell and paddled off using the ends of his wings. Then came the owl, the crane, the bluebird, the snipe, the blackbird, and so on. But as they prepared themselves for the voyage, someone noticed the partridge hadn't built a canoe for himself. Because mine is going to be special. And at an appointed time, all the birds assembled on the banks to behold this wonderful new canoe. Now, the partridge had reasoned that if a boat has two ends and it can be paddled two ways, then if it was all ends, if it was round, it could be rowed every way. So he made a canoe, which was exactly like a nest or perfectly round. But when the partridge, having entered his canoe, and began to paddle, it simply went round and round and round. It was useless. And once more, all the birds stood and laughed and laughed and laughed. He was humiliated. In vain he went ashore, and flying far inland, he hid himself for shame under the low bushes on the earth, where he remains till this day. And that's the reason why he never seeks the sea or the rivers, and has remained ever since an inland bird, and it doesn't roost in pear trees. But that song may have had its origins in an ancient French nursery rhyme. La Perdron. In the first month of the year, what will I give my sweetheart? In the first month of the year, what will I give my sweetheart? A partridge that goes, that comes, that flies. A partridge that flies in the woods.
Au premier mois de l'année, que donnerai-je à ma vie? And so it goes on. 12 young girls, nice and beautiful, 11 fine boys, 10 oxen in the meadow, 9 dairy cows, 8 white sheep, 7 scent hounds, 6 hares in the fields, 5 rabbits scratching the ground, 4 ducks flying in the air, 3 common wood pigeons, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge that comes, that flies, a partridge that flies in the woods. No mention of a pear tree, though. So why the pear tree? Well, there's a couple of theories, the first of which has been ridiculed by scholars.
but it's got a fair bit of traction on the internet. And it suggests that the words were originally a secret catechism song for 16th century Catholics, unable to practice their faith publicly, and that the bird, the partridge in the tree, represented Christ. The tree was the cross. They could sing this song safely together. Perhaps. It goes on. The three French hens are faith, hope and charity, the theological virtues. The four calling birds are the four gospels. The five golden rings are the first five books of the Old Testament. The six geese are laying are the 6 days of creation, and so on. Interestingly, there was an ancient Scottish version, which includes the line, an Arabian baboon. Whether she would thank you for that, and how it scans, I don't know. But my money is on this. It was French from the original region of Brittany. As it crossed the channel, it would have become a bilingual song. At one stage, it would have included both the English and the French words for a partridge. A partridge, eh? Un perdu. And only over time, as an understanding of French began to diminish, un perdu, un perdu, un perdu, un perdu, un perdu, a pear tree, a pear tree. Sorted.
The sound of the grey partridge here, this week's mystery bird.
No, not convinced.
I must get when you said you started talking about shades, I went, eh? What? I've got no idea at all with that, but you know, 50 Shades of Grey, I can just about see it.
Yeah, no, but the French perdu, per tree.
Oh no, I would go with you 100% on that one. 100% on that one. I think you've nailed that one. But you know,
it is a unique event.
Well, it is a unique event, and if we don't know it, we make it up on this programme. This week, we've been very excited by the arrival of spring. We're only 4 weeks away from the clocks changing, the days are getting longer, and the weather is milder. And what do? You sit and think about it.
Winter is currying in. Family bozy, house mouse cosy. It's damp wool and runny noses, chapped hands and frozen toeses. Snell blasts rocking the house and rain lashing the windows. It's steam rising from stick to your ribs soup. Winter is being curled up like a nut in its shell, a leaf in its bud, a tree in its seed. Winter is lighting a little sun in the hearth to push back the dark and make the shadows dance. Winter is enduring. Winter is sleeping. Winter is waiting. Then one night the cold loses its grip and you hear geese flying under a hazy moon. A fox yelps 3 times, a roebuck barks, and a sad solitary owl sings half a song. There is no reply, for his one true love is gone. The very next morning, spring comes. The day stretches and lengthens like a waking cat. The leaf unfurls and the tension between earth and sky becomes irresistible. Green life is pulled, dragged almost, out of the cold, dark ground, reaching for the blue. The gorse blooms chrome yellow, a colour you can smell, tropical seas and white sands. Crocuses open up their saffron hearts, and the brass section, the daffodils, come into the play position, presenting themselves to the lips of a soft wind. Skylarks rise up and pour liquid song onto the fields, while every tree, every twig, every patch of grass is being fought over, defended, subdivided by blackbird, robin and rook, a comic opera of sex and violence played out in the bushes. Meanwhile, we sit on the bench, faces upturned to the sun, seeing it through closed eyelids, warm-veined and blood-red. Winter jackets are unzipped, gloves and woolly hats laid down, the annual Scottish striptease, slow and gay cautious-like, for you never know, this might not be spring. There's still snow in the dyke.
Is that what counts as a cautionary tale?
I think so. There's bad times coming.
Aye, we'll pay for it yet. Aye.
Aye. I met somebody the other day, a television person. Mm-hmm. He said, where do you find all this stuff? Where do you get it? I said, no, we write it.
Yeah. Yeah, you should try it sometime. Got a lovely letter here from Philip Swainson. He got the correct answer, Grey Partridge. He says, I've listened to the programme for years, was even interviewed on it many years ago. I had an interesting house guest, one Silvo Caro from Slovenia, who then could have claimed the title of best climber in the world. I organised a couple of lectures for him to deliver and went climbing with him on my 47th birthday. We drove to Cullen and were interviewed by Mark. I remember Mark commenting on his hands. I remember his hands too. They were, I mean, I've got big hands, but this guy was just ridiculous. Unbelievably strong looking hands. Interesting how things link. Just listening to David Bohari talking about Cerro Torre in Patagonia, because Silva did two new climbs in that mountain 30 years ago. Both, I believe, are still unrepeated. You know, we have talked to an awful lot of people over the years. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, we have. I'm going to squeeze in a quick one. Zandra said, I'm watching my southeast garden, watching the moon, the snow moon, with noisy parakeets flying across it.
Wow.
Just like boys on the bikes in E.T.
Wonderful. Listen, that's it for this week. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast at noon today and our midweek podcast on Wednesday, which this week features a remarkable guy called Chris Lewis making his way on foot around the coastline of the UK on foot. Thanks for listening.